So, I think we're about to start. So, welcome again to another edition. And today we're going to be talking about social signal processing. And that was where we left off yesterday. So, before that, some technical remarks. So first one concerning the exam. Some of you might have gotten my email that I put online a exam fact sheet, which contains all the information on the exam. So I guess the date is 3rd of August, somewhere around 11 in the morning. And it'll take place in the large Maschinenwesen lecture hall. So we'll all be crammed together there. So the computing as well as the gaming students. Most of you, or I should have said this during the organizational session, maybe not all of you were present. So in order for you to make the exam a bit more predictable, it will be, it has 25 questions and equal number of points for each question, so 10 points, right? So that makes a total of 250 points. And in terms of the mapping of points to grades, it is, statistically governed by what you and the other students achieve, right? So the better you are, in general, the grading schema will adopt to that, or the worse you are, depends on how you want to put it. And considering the sorrows that some of the game students through the years had, I'm just a fourth year bachelor and I have to compete against all those master students, so it's only natural that the master students will draw up the whole schedule, the whole grading schema. This is not the case. So in the past 2 years, it was the case that the games bachelor students pulled down the schema. So I can grade these exams differently, but what I did, I graded them equally using the grading schema that I based on the achievements of the game students from the fourth semester. So that's a bonus for the master students because they'll be very well off with this, right? So it's not to the disadvantage of the game students, but rather to the advantage of the master students, right? So don't worry, it'll all be good. Now, in order to give you an idea of the questions, you know that I take 40% of the actual exams questions out of the question pool of the questions that are at the end of each slide set, right? And there is a game theoretic motivation for this, right? So one style of exam can be, you have like 5 or 6 old exams at hand, usually from the past years, together with the solutions, and then you can guess what the next one will be. So this is, for example, in action in some of my other lectures and tutorials that I give. But this is more intended for you to take these questions and try to answer them while preparing for the exam, right? And to thoroughly do so. And that will stimulate your networking, the respective tasks and phenomena and definitions from the lecture, while at the same time, developing some own vision on these things, yeah? And since you know then know the style, the granularity, the level of difficulty, my guess would be that you then have a very good guess what the actual exam will be like, right? And so 40% are usually sufficient to pass. So if you answer all the questions properly, you should already be on the safe side. However, what I would not advise you to do, I know that there are collections of answers for these things floating around, but these are just subjective views, right? So if I were you, I wouldn't try to just learn them by heart and then just spit them out in the exam, because that's not of much use, right? And if I happen to get the impression that an answer was just something that someone learned without understanding, I will severely, obviously, take away some points, because that doesn't make sense, right? If it just sounds like the right answer, it's probably not actually the right answer. So I would advertise for you to make your own minds about these questions and try to come up with real answers for them. That would be a good preparation for the exam. And this is practice in some... I got the idea actually from Sweden, because a friend of mine had a math exam there, an oral math exam. And actually, she knew beforehand what the problems were. So the professor gave her 10 really hard problems that she had the chance to work on for a week, right? And then the actual exam was... The oral exam was just discussing those solutions, right? So it would be like a delayed, mixed written oral exam. So it's, in a sense, it's fair, because you know that there is nothing exotic that you're being asked which you didn't expect. But on the other hand, it also requires preparation and it requires some understanding. So I think it's a good model, and yeah, well, this is the way it's going to be like. The repeat exam will be on the 30th of September, right? And you're, as always, you're free to choose whatever exam you like to write. If it's that one, 3rd of August, take that. If it's the one in September, take that. I don't care, right? As for the other things, it's all written in the exam fact sheet, okay? If there should be any other questions, just direct them at me. Now, good, we're left with two more topics to discuss in this lecture, at least what I plan to do. So that's social signal processing that we'll be dealing with today and tomorrow. And then there's introduction into game theory basics, which we will discuss in the next week. So that gives us 3 weeks where there will be no lecture, according to my plan. But what we're going to have in the last week of the semester is a question hour, right? So taking the usual slots of this spot here on Tuesday, we'll be discussing your questions, right? So this will be something. So it's not actually 3 weeks without anything, but it's more like 2.5 weeks without anything. And that, from my point of view, should make up for the fact that I took every Wednesday, right? So we're still back to 3 hours of lecture, as far as I know, right? And if you want me to do something in addition, I'm currently pondering whether I should do something on graph visualization, maybe for one Tuesday more. Yeah. So I will quickly calculate this through, but taking tomorrow and the next Wednesday will be pretty much done with the core stuff, okay? And that gives you time to prepare for other things. Good. So, and if there should be, so now the exercise is going well, right? So I think that Christoph is responding well to all the questions that you have, and that things, yeah, go as planned, as far as I see it, right? As for the games engineering lab course, well, the situation is a bit mixed, what the tutors tell me, because there are some groups that did not really upload anything to GitHub yet, and it seems that they also do not react to communication that is attempted or targeted at them by the tutors. So I don't know what's happening there, but if you would really like to continue, I would really suggest that you meet with your tutors, right? So in games engine design, I know that there was one tutor hour per week where every tutor was there. We even have a more luxurious version, so you can make appointments with your own personal tutor if you like to. And this is something that games engineering students did not really... And not really many of those groups did that. So that's an offer by us. That's an important element of teaching. Right? So I would strongly advertise to speed up there. Good. Now, social signal processing, something that we started last time, right? So we said that, okay, well, social networks that we've been dealing with a lot so far are an expression of long-term social context, but there is a whole world in short-term social context that we can also treat and measure and model and use with informatics or computer science methods, right? And the great thing about these things, as I said yesterday, last week, is that in contrast to individual behavior, which is really very diverse and can be very diversely motivated, social protocols are rather uniformly valid, right? So that's something where we can really rely on to be valid. And thus, it is a good chance to model that and to exploit these formal uniform rules that exist in these short-term social realms. Okay? Now, trying to understand what social intelligence is, we can come up with these two attempts of definitions. And we'll see how social signal processing as a scientific field fits in there. Okay? Now, for humans, obviously, social intelligence is equivalent to the ability to express and recognize social signals or social behaviors. So that is this two-fold thing between analyzing and synthesizing. Yes, so we must have both things to be able to intelligently interact, right? And this ability to express and recognize social signals from other human individuals is always targeted towards functioning in a society, right? So we know that what distinguishes us from lions or chimpanzees or bonobos or gorillas is not so much our analytical intelligence, but our very strong ability to socialize, right? And this is not only restricted to friendship making or mating or whatever. This is also especially in view of sharing workloads, right? So you can trust the lady at the bakery shop to give you the roll if you give her a euro, right? So that's remarkable given that in predator-prey ecologies, it's more like fearing not to be eaten by someone, right? And so our society is highly diverse in terms of how we rely on each other, and this is remarkable in the world of animals, right? So functioning in a society together with other human individuals is the goal, and we can, up to a sufficient level of accuracy, model this functioning in terms of Pareto optimizing my own and other humans' utility function. And we do so via cooperating, right? So if I had to sew all my clothing myself and to really raise all the crops and the animals that I eat, I would have a hard time. So labor sharing and work diversification actually contributes a lot to optimizing our utility function. And that's why we invented all those things, such as universities, cars, and farms and stuff like this, right? And Pareto optimization means that my actions should be as such that they don't lower other people's utility when trying to maximize my own, right? And that's this leads into political science, right, and into those fields. What's the appropriate political system for a society? Is it like socialism? Is it communism? Is it capitalism? Whatever, right? And all these different political systems have different ethics with respect to how strongly you are supposed to regard this Pareto principle, right? So in capitalism, it's maybe okay to lower someone else's utility function if I have the chance to raise my own by a substantial amount, whereas in other societies, it's maybe not as accepted, right? Now, IT systems, and you've probably have read this already, the definition is really very similar. So obviously we also need to algorithmically be able to express and recognize social signals, where the clear emphasis is on recognition and detection. And normally a computer detects human social behavior, but it is not excluded that other IT systems or IT agents, individuals, are the actors, right? And this plays a role in terms of robot interaction and distributed AI, right? And it is also the case that a agent, a robot, or another intelligently acting IT system is then also trying to optimize its utility function, its own utility function, while not decreasing other IT agents, that is other robots, for example, utility function. So that's these blue things make up the whole field of distributed AI. And if you read through a modern AI book, such as Russell Norvig, for example, which is the standard AI book, and most of you will have done introduction into AI, it from the beginning takes a distributed AI stance, right? So it's not that the me and the computer system, it's much more socially oriented. And there is another very good book by Michael Wooldridge about multi-agent systems thinking, which kind of unifies all the traditional stuff like distributing tasks among agents, searching, and all these other things, right? So that's distributed AI, and that's not what we would want, but we're more interested in those green things, so the interaction between computers and humans, or the interaction between humans that is mediated by a computer, right? So that's much more, in the end, what we're after in social signal processing. Good. The question is, well, assuming that we are able to analyze social signals, how can we use that? And obviously, we must distinguish between core social signal processing and behavior detection, right? Because behavior detection is something that is in a way more general and also includes individual persons' behaviors. And in that regard, it's very crucial that we distinguish systems applications that make use of individual context and systems applications that actually make use of social context. So one example is the whole field of smart home applications, right? So this has a lot to do with behavior detection, right? So let's assume that your old and frail grandmother lives alone in her apartment. The question is, well, what is normal behavior for an 80-year-old old lady, right? When do you call the ambulance, right? Is it if the old lady just feels like lying on the floor for a few seconds because she likes to whatever, should that already trigger calling the ambulance, right? So what's a non-normal behavior? But that's strongly individual context, right? Because that's, you detect, for example, and there's really conferences about that try to detect what's the activity of cooking spaghetti bolognese, right? So this obviously involves cutting some onions and preparing the tomato, blitchy, blotchy stuff and all these things. And these are different sub-activities that you can detect using computer vision and other methods. We'll look at this later on, right? But that's not social, right? Another thing could be emotion detection. But again, we have to distinguish, right? So emotion detection is usually considered social signal processing in a sense, yeah? Because, from a logical point of view, it's clear that you can also have emotions when you're alone, right? So we have to distinguish these things. However, the techniques are very similar for, individual behavior analysis. For example, emotion detection and emotion detection that's targeted at detecting emotions that are directed to someone else. Okay. Availability management is another field that a PhD student of us is working at. So obviously, modern IT systems do a lot of things proactively, right? So the telephone rings or some news is being emailed to you and it makes ding, dang, dong and whatever sounds and lights flash up. And the question is, when is it appropriate for an IT system to interrupt you? So again, if you're in an individual scenario, it's really very hard to tell, just judging your individual context, when it's appropriate. Because, yeah, you sitting there somewhere pondering can be you're totally bored, or it can mean you're really seriously thinking about something. And in those two cases, it's a very different availability management behavior would be required. So this is very hard to tell, but there's also a lot of work on this. And what the Flo Schulze, for example, that's also currently conducting the speech processing lab course, is working on, and what we're working on is, detecting social situations and deducing from the social situation whether it's appropriate. So as I said, for example, currently we're having a social situation. Yeah, this is governed by a lot of behaviors. I behave, you behave, there's a seating arrangement, there's a geometry of interaction, there's a lot of things that tell you, yeah, I'm in a social situation and this is called lecture. And again, set of appropriate and inappropriate behaviors. And if we're able to detect such things, then social situations, for example, and distinguish them and put them into equivalence classes, we can be good availability management computer systems, right? Because right now this is equivalent to a cinema or a church service or a wedding or whatever, and it's not appropriate to let the phone ring very loudly. Okay, and this is a typical short-term social context, such a social situation, because we share that, everybody knows what everybody knows, so there is full mutual knowledge, and this is what we would call a social situation. Other ideas could be like react to student emotions that you detect on their faces, right? So the typical, the eyes focus to infinity, people let their heads go down, which I see every time. And that could be an indicator for the teacher to slow down or to tell something more interesting or to shut up altogether and let the students do something, right? So a normal lecture is certainly not the ideal form, as I always say, for teaching. Now, and recommender systems, these are typical systems. So Wolfgang is currently lecturing in the other hall about recommender systems. And if you use the short-term individual context, so where are you, what are you currently doing, then you can, for example, build recommender systems that actually use that context. Yeah? So a restaurant recommender should know where you are roughly and not recommend you a pizzeria in New York City, right? However, it can also take up social signal processing techniques such as detecting your emotional state. Right? If you're feeling very sad, it might not be appropriate to suggest you a movie like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something. Yeah? Or it might maybe totally appropriate. I don't know if it cheers you up. I don't know what type of person you are. However, it's clear that there are some opportunities there. But this would not be a social context in the genuine sense, but more individual context. And, having a social situation as a short-term social context, you can, for example, use that in group recommender systems, right? So in proactive group recommender systems. If you're running around with three persons, it would be nice for a computer system to indicate to the group that, for example, a nice restaurant is around the corner, because the system knows it's lunchtime and it has not been asked. It's a proactive system, right? And in contrast to individual recommender systems, which either work on this user item rating matrix that I introduced to you a few hours ago, or that just compare item profiles and user profiles and see which one match, a group recommender system takes instead of one single profile, a number of profiles, and then again has to decide, what type of item is appropriate for all of the group and what does it mean for all of the group. Again, you can choose Pareto in a Pareto optimal fashion or least hurting or whatever, using whatever principles, right? This is a field of group recommender systems. And so there's a lot of other possibilities how and where and in which way we can use the detected social phenomena in computer systems. And the common name is socially aware computing, which is a special form of context-aware computing. You might want to distinguish this again from personalization, which is a much more static, very long-term oriented, very individual type of adaptive computer system, right? So you just change your preferences. That would be personalization. Whereas context-aware computing dynamically reacts on changing contexts in a more proactive fashion, if you would like to have this distinction. Now, there's another term that's floating around in this community, and that's reality mining. That's a term, I think I mentioned this a couple of times, that has been generated by Alex Pentland at MIT Media Lab. And what they do is they analyze all available traces of human behavior, right? So that does not restricted to social behavior. And what they then do is they derive models for this behavior, on the one hand, to deepen simply the scientific knowledge. So if there's a model for, let's say, human interaction geometry, this is just some sociological knowledge. But in most cases, they're interested in applications, right? So, for example, predicting certain behaviors in the future, right? And this is clearly interesting for all sorts of advertising, recommender systems, or whatever other things. And one famous example of their research was had the task to invent a system where they would like to predict the success of a selling interaction on the phone, right? So someone calls you and tries to sell you something. So your first few words tell an experienced human cold acquisition guy or girl, this is not going to lead somewhere, and well, he or she can then terminate the attempt. But machines could also, right? And machines could predict where certain things are going and make these accountants not waste their time, and the customer's time is also not wasted, right? Obviously, the special focus of their research is that they concentrate on non-virtual, direct, physical behaviors that they preferably record with mobile sensors. So it's not so much what people post on the web. This is also maybe reality, and that's also a thing that you can mine. But what they understand by this is this focus on physical, real-world behavior. And Alex Pentland wrote a book that's called Honest Signals, where he emphasizes that true physical life behavior that is not obfuscated by, trying to sell something as posting on Facebook is a source for real knowledge about persons, right? So they cannot hide all of their behaviors. Think of a system that detects lies or something, yeah? And, reality mining somehow encompasses or overlaps with social signal processing, but since they also analyze all traces and not only specifically social behaviors, this is maybe a larger field, if you like. Okay. Good. So, what are social signals? What are behavioral cues? And what's social behavior? Right. So, social behavior, as we will see, is on longer temporal scales. So, examples would be expressing attitude, for example, towards a social setting. And one such thing is the phenomenon of mirroring, right? And this has been well researched in sociology. If people are somehow attracted by another, and that's not restricted to man-woman type of attraction, but any attraction is likely to produce mirroring behavior. And that encompasses gestures as well as language use, right? So people that like each other tend to be even more congruent in their use of complicated sentences, wording, foreign terms, and all these other language pragmatics, if they like each other, right? And there is also a phenomenon that is investigated that people that are attracted by each other adopt the same gestures as the other one, right? So if one plays with his hair, the other one is very likely or more likely to also play with his or her hair than not playing with his or her hair, right? And this is mirroring. Other things, expressive turn-taking behavior in a conversation, express of disapproval of something or other expressions of sympathy or empathy or whatever, right? So this is more long-term than these other things. Now, behavioral cues, as we will see, are very short-term, right? As the name suggests, they hint toward social behavior. And in, examples for behavioral cues can be certain facial expressions. So if I do something like this, and this, whatever it means, yeah, it's a behavioral cue, right? Or if I appear to really open my eyes, it can be a behavioral cue indicating that I'm, well, surprised by something, yeah? And body posture and interaction geometry can also be a behavioral cue. Gestures, these things, right? So what do I intend when I try to do this? Yeah. So there's a lot of complicated messages encoded. So for example, if in this gesture, it's a generalizing gesture which opens up some virtual space and might communicate to you that there is much more depth to what I'm to the phenomenon that I'm currently explaining, but I just can't for temporal reasons, right? And I'm continue doing this, right, all the time, like James Last died. Okay, good. Expressives like laughter and emotions that are reflected in speech prosody, right? So, for example, if I'm anxious or if I'm sad, it's reflected in the way that I speak. Good. So, and obviously, as we will see, social signals are intermediate between behavioral cues and social behavior. So, social signals are, in a sense, made up of behavioral cues, right? So, multiple such cues combine to produce a social signal, okay? And what we can see in this black and white cross-sectional image, for most, and there have been instances of this lecture where people severely protested against this interpretation, so I would say it's pretty clear that those two have an argument, and it's a heated argument, right? They're singing in a duet, right? Could be like the same thing, yeah? So, but let's so the prior probability for an argument, for a heated argument, is a bit higher than the prior probability for a Schlager-style expressive Helene Fischer duet. But I don't know, right? So this is, so if you were to classify this, you also have to take into consideration not only the pattern probability, but also the prior probability for something, right? So remember if the lecture on classification, so what we're interested in is the probability of a certain class being something like I, given that you have a vector of patterns or a vector of features, I should say. So this is the probability that you would like to assess. So what's the posterior probability of a duet given the features, and what's the posterior probability of a heated argument given the same features, right? And we know we can use Bayes in order to have these class conditional densities, but then you would also have the class priors, right? And this is what you would also use for classification. So you would maximize, you would try to find this setting for C, which maximizes this probability, right? And in order to do that, you have to incorporate the prior probabilities as well. However, we see that there is a lot of these behavioral cues, for example, the poster of the man, yeah, and we can only conclude that this is a man from the chin, right, for example, but it could also be a very virile woman. I don't know, yeah. But yeah, the probability that it's a man is much higher, okay? So the forward posture, the mutual gaze, so seen from the angle of the heads, the opening of the mouths, the gestures, the interpersonal distance, so clearly he invades her intimate space, and we can say so that he does that because he has the forward posture whereas she has the backward posture. And this is the case in a duet as well, right? But it's much more likely that we're talking about aggression here. Good. And we're apparently very good at interpreting these behavioral cues. So A, nonverbal social behavioral cues is manifested via a time series of perceivable or measurable nonverbal physiological activity, right? So nonverbal means that we are neglecting the content of communication. So we're not regarding what is actually being communicated, what is actually spoken. Now, nonverbal can also include audio, right? So if you just regard the way that someone is speaking, yeah, then if you want to include this into your definition, you may do so, right? So if you're just investigating speech prosody and not what is actually spoken, then we might include this into behavioral cue. But normally, nonverbal behavioral cues are meant by the term behavioral cue, and nonverbal clearly is targeted towards gestures and face expressions and things that can be detected optically and not with an audio measurement. Okay, and nonverbal social signals are composed of or manifested via a series of behavioral cues, right? In the extreme case, it can be one behavioral cue, so then the time series is very short, but usually there are some where the number is not really extremely high behavioral cues, right? And we can distinguish between conscious or unconscious social signals, right? So if I do this, then this is a social signal. You all know how to interpret this, right? And I consciously communicate that. At the same time, when I'm doing this all the time, this is also a social signal that you can interpret. For example, well, is he in good mood, or is he well prepared for the lecture, or less well prepared, or is he nervous or not? And depends on the speed and the amplitude of the gestures, right? And it's if it's more like this, it's a different one, right? And social behavior is then manifested by a series of social signals. For example, aggressive behavior is clearly made up of a chain, a series of social signals, and these are, for example, in this region here, a lot of behavioral cues, a lot of gazing and stuff, right? Good. So, surprisingly so, nonverbal behavior makes up for the majority of evidence that we use for our social perception. So it's much more interesting what people nonverbally do in terms of interpreting the social aspects of their interaction than what the actual verbal content is. So there is in the paper that I have as a background reading, there's a figure of around below 10% that makes up the actual verbal content. Speaking of the paper, so you know that every part has its background reading paper, and in this case it is a survey paper by an Italian social signal processing expert, Alessandro Vinciarelli, which is very well known. And there's even a more recent version. So you might remember the lecture on real-world social networks, where I told you that we have this 2000-and-something paper by Mark Newman that I took as a background reading, but there's this new book by him with 400 or 500 pages, which is much more recent, right? And the same situation is here, so Alessandro Vinciarelli has another, a bit thicker survey paper out, but I took the simpler one that is a few years, I guess 2 years older than the other one. But if you want to refer to the newer one, you can easily find it on the web, right? And I uploaded the paper on Piazza, right? So always the recommendation, please read the background reading. Good. So, well, speaking of the temporal domain, social signals and behavioral cues are typically in the range of microseconds to seconds, whereas social behavior is typically in the temporal domain of minutes to hours. Okay, and Alessandro Vinciarelli cites a very good paper that I also downloaded and read about types of messages that are conveyed by such behavioral rules, right? And, well, one type of message is communicating a state that you're actually in. So this can be an affective or emotional state, an attitudinal or a cognitive state, right? So if I'm in doubt, this would be like a cognitive state. If I'm sad, this would be like an affective state. And for example, if I disagree, this would be like more like an attitudinal state. Then there's other types of messages, for example, emblems. And these are typically culture-specific messages that are conveyed by behavioral cues. And, for example, thumbs up. Yeah. So in the Western society, everyone understands that. If you're a diver, then this means something different, because if you're a diver, this means I'm going up, and thumbs up actually means okay in the diver's language. But if someone from the Arabic countries can confirm that, there's another meaning for this gesture, right? So whatever it is, cultural specific, okay? So, however, within a certain culture, these things can be understood, okay? Then there is another class, which in the paper is called manipulator, but actually in the core paper that is cited is called adaptator. And these are actions that act on objects in the environment, or self-manipulative actions, such as biting your lip or playing around with objects. And these are usually involuntary, they're habitual, and they're very honest in terms of they really convey an underlying state of mind or an attitude without the possibility to consciously manipulate them, right? So that's why they are called adaptators, because we are trying to adapt habitually to some state, right? And then there is illustrators, right? You name it, right? Things like that. Or raised eyebrows, such as I really doubt what you're currently saying. And regulators, right? So if you, for example, are in a heated conversation and want to take the turn, you want to speak, then you would maybe use gestures such as, and also these non-verbal utterances such as, things like that, that indicate, well, now I doubt something and I would like to take the turn. And these can be modeled, detected, and, well, classified using machine learning techniques, right? So in essence, what you always do in social signal processing, you have an annotated data set, you learn some classifier, and for example, in a lie detector system, you would for each sentence have a two-class classification problem. Is that the truth or isn't it the truth? Or you can also turn this into a regression problem if you have a degree of truthfulness between 0 and 1. And you have always have a vector of features, however they are built, and then you train such a system, like a support vector machine or other systems. Yeah? So here we have a table of such behavioral cues, right? So these are here on the y-axis. And on the x-axis, we have examples of aspects or example aspects of social behaviors, and another column that talks about how these things are technically or algorithmically treated, or yeah, treated sensor-wise, right? So we have whole families of behavioral cues. So for example, physical appearance, gestures and postures, facial and eye behavior, vocal behavior, and, well, space and environment. I would maybe put this together here with physical appearance, and we're going to look at a much more detailed example at the end of this lecture. And such example aspects of social behaviors are emotion, personality, status, dominance, persuasion, regulation, rapport, and this refers to whether you trust someone or not, and clearly each family of behavioral cues has its associated technology. For example, if you want to do something with audio, then obviously you need audio sensors, you need audio-based features, and audio-targeted or specific classifier and machine learning systems. Computer vision is something else, so you work with cameras and transformations and pixel or hog features and stuff. And biometric features are the whole range of things that, for example, measure your heart rate or your skin resistance and all these things. And this is currently a large family of sensors that is upcoming for fitness. And you know that the Apple Watch and all these newer products heavily target the market for fitness applications. So this is another field that is also coming up. So let's speak of all these families, and what we will do is we will take another quarter of an hour, go through these, and then maybe with an emphasis on tomorrow, we'll try to talk about actual machine learning techniques to model, measure, and handle these things. So, physical appearance, right? This is wild. You might say it's not a typical social signal or behavioral cue family. It actually does communicate a lot involuntarily, right? So you might know these human somatotypes like endomorphic, ectomorphic, and mesomorphic types that tend to communicate, yeah, what everybody knows. If someone is rather thick and, yeah, rather, well, bulky, then this communicates being a calm and very easygoing personality, whereas these ectomorphic, very thin people, yeah, as a tendency, appear to be more active, to be more nervous, to be more neurotic. Yeah? However, this is not always true, and that's just a probability distribution, but this is clearly something that people can perceive, and there's at least some truth in it, at least for some types of social applications, right? And obviously, what you have there is natural characteristics and also artificial characteristics. So makeup, jewelry, clothing, all these things communicate a lot about social attitude, for example, right? So I can easily switch from BWL mode to a nerd mode, yeah, just by changing the way that my collar is arranged, right? And there's a lot of things associated with that. So the whole field of research on attractiveness, and there's also researchers trying to come up with algorithms for attractiveness, right? And there's things as the halo effect. So beautiful people are perceived as more competent than ugly people. This is something that you can measure with experiments. And the question is, what is a computer scientist's concern about these things? Well, if you think of, let's say, a matchmaking portal that brings together either experts or a dating portal or whatever, it is of interest to maybe know who's attractive, who needs maybe more suggestions, I don't know, right? Or to counteract the halo effect, right? So if you're in HR, for example, in the US, it's frowned upon that you add photos to your application because people want to exclude being influenced, being biased by someone that's especially good looking, right? And you can also use this in your applications to whatever extent, okay? Other examples are, for example, that taller persons are usually perceived as more, not necessarily competent, but more powerful as small people. So if you, for example, do a statistics on CEOs' body height, you will find that they are significantly taller than others. And this, again, can be used to the advantage or disadvantage of one or the other group, right? And the methods would then be computer vision methods to detect them. Well, obviously, gestures and postures are also clearly related to expressing emotions. So if you're, I always cite the virtual latissimus, people that go like this, and would have a stance like this, and it's clear what this conveys. While if I'm fumbling around, if I'm a shoe gazer like this, it conveys something different. And as I said, Alex Pentland's book emphasizes that especially those unconscious gestures and postures communicate a lot of honest signals about your true social state or your true attitude, right? And one example for such unconscious behavioral cues is these adaptators. So manipulation of own body parts, like hair twisting. And you know that there is research establishing that, again, if people find other people attractive, they would do these compensatory adaptatorial gestures, like playing with the hair, right? So this is a typical cliché. So the probability of that is not really such that you can really build a classifier on that, right? So if you go out and talk to people and find someone playing with his or her hair, it's not a super chance that you can say, this person is in love with me. But there's a higher probability of such things if there's some sort of attraction. Yeah, and the same is here with these folding gestures, or whether you have something, an inclusive or an exclusive posture, right? And speaking of that, posture is a very important behavioral cue. And what we can try to classify these things is whether they're inclusive or exclusive, whether so they communicate the willingness to interact or the unwillingness to interact. So if I lean away from someone and fold the arms and put forth my leg to just increase the distance, then this is a non-inclusive posture, whereas these two here have congruent inclusive postures, right? Relative body orientation we're going to look at in more detail at the end. And as I said, congruent versus incongruent has to do with these mirroring effects, right? And here we have an example of a non-congruent posture. So she's obviously trying to be to constructively discuss something, whereas he is more in this typical male position of So walking style, status, dominance, it's clear what is meant by this. So, speaking of the interaction geometry, what's very interesting is obviously the interpersonal distance. We'll get this in a few minutes on a slide. But also the relative body orientations and body positions, right? And what you can see here is an experiment that we conducted, I guess, 3 years ago in one of the labs of Professor Nawab, where we tried to, monitor the interaction geometry of people interacting and then try to come up with an algorithm for social situation detection. So you can see that this has been a long while since these two have already completed their PhDs by now. But we made some subsequent experiments where we tried to assess the differences between men and women and inclusive cultures and exclusive cultures. And there is interesting stuff to be learned there. Now, that was gestures and postures. Now, in terms of emotion, I already told you that there is a whole field, affective computing, founded by at least significantly influenced by Ross Picard and others at MIT Media Lab, which try to assess emotion from all kinds of visual and audio features. And there is several systems for encoding emotion that we already talked about in the first slide set. So Ekman's system corresponds to a six-dimensional emotional space. So he distinguishes these six basic emotions: fear, sadness, happiness, anger, disgust, and surprise. However, this is maybe a bit coarse. So another classification system is this wheel of emotion by Plutchik, where these emotions radiate out, and the distance from the center encodes the intensity of the emotion. So the closer it is to the center, the higher the more intense is the emotion. But each one corresponds to an emotional direction, so to speak. And since these are color-coded, the complementary color is intended to indicate the complementary emotion, right? So the very counterpart to ecstasy is grief, and in the less intense version, joy and sadness, or serenity and pensiveness, right? And admiration, loathing, rage, terror. And you can already see that, to some extent, these things are complementary, but to some other, they may be in line, right? Because real terror and real rage are associated with, a lot of activation in terms of that. So you can say, well, this is maybe a thing that is related to intensity only, but in some sense, not every of these things is as complementary as the other pair. So this is just a way to try to arrange this. And speaking of, so we have basically four real axes in there, and since we can encode this from -1 to 1, for example, you can come up with a four-dimensional vector model for emotions, right? And this has been used, for example, in several bachelor's theses that I supervised, and currently there's a master's thesis trying to model these emotion algebraic interactions between game characters, right? If someone's interested in that, talk to me. Then there is personality traits, and among systems for measuring personality traits, the OCEAN system, or the Big Five inventory, is the most well-known. So this measurement system tries to characterize personalities with these five dimensions, and everyone has contributions in each five dimensions. And the dimensions are openness, so how open are you as a personality, how conscientious, how extroverted, how agreeable, and how neurotic, right? And well, if you encode this from 0 to 1, you have, again, a vector space that you can use to characterize personalities of people. And I might have told you, so I'm currently in the process of I'm co-supervising, or I'm a second supervisor for a PhD thesis of a researcher at KIT, where she is trying, for example, to relate the actual personality trait of a person in these five dimensions to, for example, the Facebook posting behavior, right? And this can in turn be interesting if you're trying to do social media assessment for advertising. So if you regard Twitter and Facebook and try to find out what people think of, let's say, a razor or another product, right? What you need to do is you need to do sentiment analysis, so emotion detection from text. You need to investigate the postings, right? But on the other hand, you need to be aware that people have this positive bias when they post, right? So the stuff on Facebook is much more positive than what they actually feel. And this difference can be used, or you can use models that map these things to Facebook posting behavior to rectify this, to correct the values in an appropriate way, right? And another thing is to put it the other way around, right? To use posting behavior in social media to try to predict personality traits. And this, again, can be used in marketing, right? So if you, for each personality tribe, personality trait equivalence class, there can be some measures of, let's say, advertising or customer relationship management, but that is especially targeted towards these things. So not uninteresting. Good. So face and eye behavior. Okay. Obviously, the face is the anchor point for behavioral cues. So if you want to find out about what other people think, look them in the face. So it is, well, obviously, we all know, and I have had this on the blackboard, that you need very few points to detect in your face to distinguish the basic emotions by Ekman, for example, right? So the eyebrows and certain aspects of the mouth are completely sufficient to convey the respective expression of a face, right? And what we're after is we need to be able to analyze these elements in the face to be able to say, for example, if someone, what type of message does someone want to convey with this? And in order to do that, there is something that's called the facial action coding system. And this facial action coding system is a system to, well, to be able to define features in terms of which you can classify certain facial expressions. And the building blocks are so-called action units, right? And there's there's a lot of them. And an action unit is the smallest discernible movement in a face that can be easily detected by other humans, that is conveyed by a distinct muscle or a muscle group in the face, and which takes part in these facial expressions and thus may be algorithmically detected, right? And you have 9 such action units in the upper face, several more in the lower face, several others in terms of the head position, right? And then other descriptors. So if you take this together, there are around 50 action units, and a behavioral cue or a message would then be a time series of 50 dimensional vectors, right? So you have these 50 dimensional feature space, and you can say, for example, that eyebrow raising is present or not. That would be, well, just binary such features. Or you can say that it's present in a very Spock-like fashion, or just very slightly. So then you have non-binary features, whatever you like, right? And if you take small time windows, right, or even say time doesn't matter, it's just that I have some implicit time and I have the sequence of such action units occurring, then I have a time series that I can use to actually encode certain expressions, right? So, for example, if a face turns from something like that to something like that, maybe the person suddenly developed some doubts about what you just said, for example, right? And this can be detected, for example, that if you would go from something like this to something like this, obviously some action units occur. Yeah, so the eyebrows change from this position to this, which kind of encodes certain messages that are conveyed via behavioral cues and social signals. Okay, and well, these things can be used to recognize emotions, cognitive states like interest or puzzlement, right? This could be interesting for this e-learning type of environment where you watch all your students, and if they're all puzzled, then you should maybe explain something again. Psychological states like suicidal tendencies, right? Not the band, but the actual tendencies, which is interesting for a psychotherapist, for example, because if you're a psychotherapist, all of your patients somehow are sad or have some mental difficulties. And it's very hard for them to kind of assess which ones are actually suicidal and need intervention and which ones can just be sent home until the next session, right? And so a experienced psychotherapist can rely on her experience. But if we had a computer system that would be very good in detecting those things, could be like an assistant system for that, right? Report, personality traits, and all types of social signals. Yeah? Good. And what's interesting is that actually some FACS-based classifier system can be better than humans in detecting certain things. For example, in alcohol intoxication, the computers are significantly better than humans. So if someone is drunk or not, this can be done with an algorithm with greater accuracy. Now, last group, or I think next to last group, is vocal behavior, right? So what are components? So first of all, the voice prosody that we'll define on the next slide, then linguistic vocalizations, non-linguistic vocalizations, silence patterns, and turn-taking. Now, what's prosody? So prosody, in essence, is a encompassing term for classes of features of audio signals of speech. For example, the pitch, the tempo, the energy, and tempo and energy are already complex features, or features that are made up in a complex way from the actual wave pattern. Okay? And obviously the prosody can be used to detect whether someone is angry or whether someone is in a state of fear, because these persons would talk with a higher energy level. If someone is feeling very comfortable and very dominant, like I'm the boss, then you will talk in a lower voice. And if someone is like more, or is feeling insecure, the voice pitch will just go up. Okay? Because like your vocal tract is being compressed, because you're feeling tense, your whole upper muscle system is under tension because you're so nervous, and then this also has its impact on the tension of the whole vocal tract, so the voice pitch goes up if you're in those states. Okay. Now, these linguistic vocalizations or segregates are all those famous non-words, like and these things. Like, and these can be they're mostly unconscious, so I don't know how high my air frequency is. So my old geography teacher had about 500 per lesson, and we counted that. And maybe I have some other things. So do you know some typical GRO segregate that I use? That is unconscious and I might not... Nothing? Do I use or something? Or any gesture? Okay, good. This one. Like the butterfly gesture. I'm trying to fly away. Cool. And these things are... Yeah, can also be used for so-called back-channeling. And that's the... If you're listening to someone and just stay like this... This is not very communicative, right? If you're actively listening, you're somehow doing something. Like in a lecture, it's harder for you to do so, right? So you gaze back and maybe you move your head in some way that kind of interacts, or you don't. Depends on what you want. And if it were like a one-to-one, you could signal me with some interest or pseudo interest. Well, that's what you use. And then there's non-linguistic vocalizations such as or laughter or crying or other types of groaning. And obviously we know how they're used to express boredom and other things. There's even theories on silence, right? There's different versions of silence. And there is this hesitation silence if people are supposed to explain difficult concepts. Then they have to take some breaks in the order of half a second or second to think and to, manage their parallel threads and processes. Then there's psycholinguistic silence, which has to do with difficulties in encoding word semantics or decoding word semantics, even in foreign languages or especially in foreign languages. And then there's such things as interactive silence, right? So the typical... Yeah, the one that I use if I'm once again angry about someone talking too much, right? And this is like an voluntary expression of a social signal in a way, right? Or expressing respect if you don't really take the turn right away, but let some time pass before you really take the turn. Speaking of turn-taking pattern, you know, that a lot of behavioral cues and social signals are there to regulate conversations, right? When you want to take the turn, you usually indicate that. And if you want to deny someone the turn, you also indicate that by, for example, raising your voice, so speaking louder and things like that. And we took part in this also in terms of social situation detection, right? So if you, let's say you're in a crowded space, right? And you have an arrangement like this, right? So there's several people standing there talking and other people are standing there talking, right? The question is who is interacting with whom? Are those two people interacting, right? Well, you can tell from their body positions seen from above that the probability is very low, right? Because they're having these angles and these distances. So if you take the turn-taking pattern of this group, it would be like a regulated pattern, right? So there is very low overlap because these people tend to coordinate their turn-taking behavior. And this is true in this small group here as well. There may be some conversation like that. There is some overlap always. So there is estimations that the overlap is in the order of magnitude of 15%. Yeah? But there is no such thing as this. Yeah. I mean, even in a very heated arguments, you will never find a turn taking like this because it's simply nonsense, right? But you can maybe have a guess that these persons are also not interacting, because if you just take the turn pattern of this person and this person, you might find something like this. Because they're simply not, there is no... no coordination, right? And this can also be used for social situation detection or other things. Okay? Good. Speaking of geometry, we all know that the space around us is somehow quantified, right? And there's an intimate zone, which can be in the order of magnitude from 0 centimeters to about 0.5 meters, typically. And there is a so-called casual personal zone, where you would let your really close and good friends and family into. And that is from 0.5 meter to about 1.2 meters. Then there is a thing that is called the socio-consultative zone, where you would let even foreign people in that you make a conversation with. And from 2 meters to infinity, we have something that we might call the public zone, right? And it's, if you can do an experiment, and it's simply very clear where, for example, the intimate zone begins, right? If I approach a person, and if the person recognizes, just then this is already too close, right? It's not close. And this? You can do the experiment, right? It's very clear that everything below 0.5 is really weird, okay? With some exceptions, okay? Good. Yeah, maybe, yes. I don't know. Good. And obviously these things are in action when you have a free space, right? So if you have a free space and you can arrange as you like, then people would do something like this, right? And they would arrange that their interpersonal distances are somehow around 1 meter, I would say, right? If they know each other and have a lively conversation. However, here in this social situation, it's clearly not the case, right? Why is this? Because the furniture imposes some socio-fugal force, if you want, right? So you just cannot move freely. You have to adhere to the furniture, to the seating pattern. And these things have been described by Watson, for example. He calls this sociopetal forces and sociofugal forces. So architecture does a lot to exert these forces. So, for example, if you're in a subway, then we all know things such as intimate spaces are simply not existent anymore, because people would stand like this, yeah, because there's simply no space. And this is a sociopetal force. Yeah? So the walls of the wagon just exert that force, okay, and the other people. While the sociofugal forces, if you, for example, let's say you're two persons and you have all the space here available, right, it's not very likely that if you don't know each other, you're both going to stand here together. The other one is standing like this. It's not very likely, right? So one is maybe standing there, and the other one will be standing in the opposite corner, right? So we don't know each other, no offense, stuff like this. So this is a sociofugal force that architecture imposes upon people. And, well, obviously, gender does play a role. So women have a tendency to place themselves slightly closer, right? Whereas in mixed gender patterns, the interpersonal distances are slightly larger. Then there is cultures that are more inclusive cultures. So a Brazilian would be much closer to you than someone from the Northern European countries like Sweden or Germany, right? And then there's these nice things where someone from a southern country moves forth and the other one moves back, yeah? Because everyone tries to adjust the respective thing, right? And actually, well, you might ask yourself, come on, why are you telling me this? Does anything have to do with computer science? Yes, we will see that. Even seating arrangements have something to do with personality and social status. So it's clear that the CEO will be very likely to sit here at this end of the table and maybe not here, right? And there's conversational seating arrangements, there's cooperative seating arrangements, and even competitive seating arrangements, right? So you can try to guess things from there. And what does that have to do with computer science? Once again, if you're designing a user interface for a tabletop system or for a public kiosk system, you must provide for enough comfortable space for the people to stand alongside of each other if they're looking together at the display, or if they're doing something like collaborative music compositions and they're standing around the table, you have to provide for each of them a territory where he can develop his or her ideas and then push it towards the public space, for example. Right? Good. So what we are doing tomorrow, will be doing tomorrow, is investigating all these things in more detail, and maybe we'll start in the last minutes. So having said that, right, so each computer scientist or game designer should have a natural intuition about these things. For example, if you develop non-player characters or other things, it's really important that they behave credible. And as we said, we can use machine learning and sensor techniques to detect social signals and then use them in socially aware applications. So that involves data capture from the sensors, and what you would typically do is split up the data according to each person individually, right? So from this unimodal behavioral stream, you would derive multimodal behavioral streams. Then you would try to do something such as behavioral cue extraction, which can mean a lot of different things, right? So if you have an audio signal, it would first involve a complicated feature computations, and then subsequently, for example, an emotion classification system, or if you have a computer vision system, it would also compute features and then try to detect these action units and so on, right? If you have these behavioral cues, you can try to then do social signal understanding, right? Because that also involves a lot of interpretation. So again, some meta-level features. So what do you know about the person? What do you know about the general interaction situation? And this is another thing that maybe comes from another feature-based, sensor-based system. And then how do you bring these things together, right? So what we see is that there is a lot of context of whatever sort. Again, social context, individual usage context, physical context, computing resources, all these things that together with the found behavioral cues have an influence on the actual estimation of the social signal. If you have them, then you can put these again together in terms of social behavior, right? And the whole field of social signal processing, with all of its contributions, has not gotten very far, I'd say, right? Because there's a lot of work to do, especially in the later stages, because all these things such as emotion detection only work up to a certain accuracy. And it's unclear, for example, how our brain is able to compose these evidences from these classification systems into something of a whole situation assessment. That's really something that a lot of work needs to be put into. Good. All right. So how can we do the data capture? So we can distinguish two types of sensors, right? So infrastructure-based sensors that are fixedly mounted to some spot in a room, right? Like a camera, for example, or even a Kinect device. Mobile sensors are another class, where sensors in mobile phones are clearly, yeah, the most important source, because we all have our mobile phones with us, and obviously there are a lot of sensors in them. GPS sensors, accelerometers, gyros, and so on. Then we have the whole thing of wearable glasses, Google Glass, eye tracking devices, and these things, and then the whole biometric stuff, pulse meters, even EEG devices, right? So people that are completely paralyzed can be made to learn to guide a cursor with their brain waves, right? So that's a clear thing that is easy to learn for them, right? So they first learn a binary classifier, right, in a sense, to deliberately guide a cursor to one of two fields, and with that they can play Stephen Hawking, right? And that's a thing that is obviously essential for them. If you can just move your eyebrow a little bit, then this is the only chance to communicate with the world. Surprisingly so, it has turned out. There was one case that was reported in some paper of a person that was really completely disabled, so nothing. And then they made these EEG-based devices, and it turned out that the person was completely conscious and fine, actually. So I don't know if it was a man or a woman, but the person dictated a letter in about 3 days or so, which said, well, I'm fine, right? It's obviously a strange situation, but after all, I'm fine, okay? And this is something, well, you can use social signal or signal processing in certain ways to be very useful for persons. Now, clearly, we have a lot of ethical things going on here. So there is there's a large opposition in terms of big data and ubiquitous computing and Internet of Things, because we're naturally increasing the number of sensors in our environment to a large amount. And the question is, do people always know what they're exhibiting themselves to, right? And one famous example is Apple just collecting all the GPS traces of people without their consent, right? Depends. So you have to be really aware of what you do there. And, well, it remains to be seen whether we as computer scientists must do something or must object some tendencies of the industry. Good. So, how can we go about? Well, first thing is audio processing. Okay, so how can we deal with audio processing? So we start with something that comes from the microphone, right? And that's clearly such a thing, a WAF signal. So, a microphone typically is an electronic device in our case, so we have some quantification. So here the signal is subdivided in a possible granularity that we can distinguish, some numerical values, as well as the time is also divided into segments where these numbers are actually computed or measured, right? So in essence, this whole thing is more like a curve like this, right? And physically, sound is nothing more as pressure as a function of time and space, right? So pressure is a scalar quantity, and waves in the pressure are sound, right? And this is what we can measure, okay? And the first thing that we need to do when we want to process something from audio is, if we want to process something from speech, I should say, is we need to distinguish which of those frames, and these frames might typically be something like 30 milliseconds or so, which frames do contain speech and which frames don't, right? So in essence, in these 30 milliseconds, you may have like several hundred numerical values. So this is a pattern, right? And what you need is a function that takes the pattern, X, and maps it to two classes, right? So one class is yes, it is speech, and the other class is no, it's not speech. And you can do this with generative classifiers here or discriminative classifiers, whatever you like. So that's the first stage. Then the second stage is, if you happen to have if you happen to have a frame or even a window of such frames that you know contain speech, yeah, then this is nice. But if there is several people speaking, you know, what we need to do is we need to split the multimodal stream into a unimodal stream. So the next thing is we need to be able to detect when one speaker ceases to talk and the other one starts to talk. And these are called, well, speaker transition points. And at the end, if we say, okay, well, here in this window there's George, and in this window there's George, and here we have, I don't know, Stefan, right? So the first thing is, if we start with this, we don't know that this is George, right? We just know that it's some speaker and this is some other speaker, okay? So what we then need to do is we need to cluster these speaker segments together. Maybe there's another one by Stefan later on, or an even longer one by Stefan, right? And then if we have them all together, one step could be that we actually classify who it is. So if we have a lot of Stefan samples and a lot of George samples, and we have clustered correctly, then we can say, then we can do the mapping that this is actually George, and this all here is Stefan, right? Nice. And if we have that, then we can do continue and go on and try to assess the speech prosody of George and say, what's the emotional state of George? Again, this is all a series of classifiers, and that's what we look at then tomorrow, right? How this works. We will then tomorrow also take a closer look at interaction geometry, which will bring us back to Gaussian mixture models. I'm sorry. We do. And then when this is finished, we'll go over to game theory. So see you tomorrow, 8:15.